The date is the 18th of February, and this is an interview with Lieutenant General S.F. Clark regarding the Harkness Papers and Perks biography.
Do you have a book by George Malaby?
3-4. Again, partly owing to the fact that we've had these people plowing in and out and sideways, I haven't been able to get through as many of these. I hope to read quite a whack of them. And get myself up in them on the Bomark, well, on the Harkness Papers and on the Bomark especially, before we come in. I thought what we'd do is discuss some of these for about, I don't know, maybe an hour and a quarter, and then go over for lunch. And incidentally, we're having lunch with, I don't know if you know him, that fellow called Alec Wood.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, you know, he's quite a character. Former dean and...
Professor here?
Yeah. He's a bacteriologist and something else, but he's had an interesting life. He's a veteran and all the rest of it. Now, you've gone through these, but it's been some time since you have gone through.
Yes.
And we ended, or at least we got up to, we got through the Arrow, and we're now on this title on the Bomark. Starting at card number one. Some of this stuff that I'm saying is for my own benefit, quite frankly. And one of the things, the first card I have is a note of Diefenbaker speaking in the House of Commons on the 20th of February 1959, in which he says, "The potential of these defensive weapons is achieved only when they are armed with nuclear warheads. The government is, therefore, examining with the United States government questions connected with the acquisition of nuclear warheads for Bomark and other defensive weapons for the use by the Canadian forces in Canada." Now, in brief, you will remember that this was a period when the Conservatives took power, that there was a... they were right on the verge of a potential technological breakthrough, shall we say, when the decision was made to scrap the Arrow and to replace it with the Bomark. And there also was one hell of a row about the Bomark. You'll also remember that there were two types of Bomark, the Bomark A and the Bomark B. Now, where were you at that time? What would your position be? How, to what extent were you involved in this?
I was CGS at the time. And, of course, we discussed this at the Chiefs of Staff Committee. Mm-hmm. And we also discussed it. The Chiefs of Staff discussed it with the minister. Mm-hmm. And the first plan, as I recall it, was to get the Bomark A. I think we in the Army countered with an analysis that we had made of it, using, of course, largely information that we got from the American Army as to the merits of the Nike versus the Bomark A, and it was our opinion at the time that if we were to go for an atomic anti-aircraft weapon, that we should, that the Nike, I think that was a Nike B, but I've forgotten the designations precisely, had a much greater first round probability of kill, but it had a more limited range. But however, we felt that for a given sum of money, you could produce better defense with Nike than with Bomark A, which in fact at that time, if I recall, had a number of test firings, and I've forgotten how many. It was 4-6, none of which was successful. There was, of course, on the other hand, that the Nike had a much more restricted range, and that the kill would have been closer to the built-up cities, or whatever you would term your term. We definitely had to guess what the target areas might be, and clearly there were going to be industrial areas, or, say, Ottawa, from a morale point of view. The main targets were clearly not in Canada, because whether we were knocked, if they knocked the Americans out, it really didn't matter whether we were in or out, because we had really no offensive, strategic offensive capability whatsoever. But nevertheless, we had to guess where these might fall for more or less to disturb the people. And that, of course, delayed, I think, the procurement of, or any intention to procure the Beaumarch A, and then we started arguing about the Beaumarch B. But again, the question was kicked around for a very long while, because it involved the government buying a weapon which had not indeed been tested.
That's the Beaumarch B.
Yes.
Yeah.
It hadn't been tested. And therefore, if one felt it was necessary to have an atomic anti-aircraft defense, first thing you should do is say, when do you want it? If you want it now, clearly, you don't buy Beaumarch A. Beaumarch B is coming along, but it hasn't even been tested yet. And indeed, Beaumarch A hadn't done very well on its test. Subsequently, it did. So that was the problem that we wrestled with for quite some time.
Yeah. Under whose command, incidentally, would it come? Would it be would you consider it an Army weapon, Air Force weapon, or what?
Which one?
The Beaumarch.
Oh, I would think it would be logical to call it an Air Force weapon if you have to designate it as such. This is a very unrewarding sort of exercise, and I suppose, in a sense, it may have influenced, not greatly, but partially, one's view in making a choice between weapons. Anti-aircraft had normally been an Army responsibility, and if you moved then from a conventional HE weapon to an atomic one, this doesn't matter very much, or whether you move from a rifled gun, which shoots up an atomic, or an HE shell to a rocket, that didn't seem to matter very much. But when you've got something of the nature of Beaumarch, which was essentially a winged, it wasn't a rocket in this, I'm probably trying to split hairs here, but I don't regard it as a rocket, it was more of a winged missile. And although no one was flying in it, therefore the Air Force would regard it, and it may have colored their choice too. It did have the advantage of the Beaumarch would have been that it would destroy the invading plane or planes, in whatever ratio, you have to go into that later, at a much greater distance. You could kill them further out, and therefore the chance of contamination from the burst of your own shell, and whether or not, and there are long arguments about this, it would detonate the larger bombs. The general consensus of opinion I got from scientists that it would destroy them and they would not detonate. So that you would have the fallout and radiation from your warhead. And that could be over on reasonably unorganized territory.
Would you say that Diefenbaker recognized at the outset, and there's argument about this, at least I've come across argument about it, the difference between the Beaumarch A and the Beaumarch B insofar as nuclear warheads are concerned?
I believe that he understood that the family of weapons that one might use for that sort of attack, a strategic attack, involved the use of an atomic warhead, whether it was a Nike Zeus or a Bomark A or a Bomark B or a Velvet Glove air-to-air, that if they were really going to be successful in their operation, they had to have the atomic warhead. I think it's almost meaningless to spend the amount of money you need for a Bomark and put a conventional warhead in it.
But the Bomark A originally was non-nuclear.
Yeah, originally. But I think when we were thinking about it, the Americans were definitely had designed their nuclear warhead for it. Now, I believe that he understood this. Certainly, I don't believe any of the chiefs of staff for one moment ever considered recommending a weapon that did not have a nuclear warhead.
Yeah.
And obviously to wait for it, because when the Americans first started these, they had, even in their rocketry, they had VT fuses in them and HE. But they were moving. They could afford to, whether they can afford it or not, they did arm themselves with these. Then they became obsolete and they bought the newer ones.
Yeah.
And our budget being a much tighter one, we had to say, well, we can't have the intermediate stage of defense. We'll go for the next step.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We have here,
if the chips had been down on the table and the war was very imminent, of course, I think that's another matter, but if you knew it was going to happen in a few months and you could have bought some Bomark A's with heads, you would have bought them, but we didn't feel this way.
Yeah. You may remember, this is Paul Hellier, who's the Liberal Defense Critic. And this is on card 11 of the Bomark papers, in which, and mind you, one would expect a liberal critic to say this. I suppose if Perks would have said this, as had he been on the other side of the house. But he's saying that the Bomark missiles are worthless. Speaking at a press conference at which he urged a major overhaul of Canadian Armed Forces, Mr. Helly would not say whether the Liberals would scrap the Bomark, and said instead, he said he would favor asking the United States if that country thought they were worth maintaining. He goes on to say, quite naturally, how the Conservatives are wasting the defense dollar and all the rest of it.
I think he had a point.
In what sense, then?
Well, if one was thinking of the use of aircraft in war, the possibility of having to use aircraft in war, fighter aircraft, now at this time I think I speak my own point of view. I'm not saying I believe the chiefs of staff thought this, because I don't remember what they thought about it. But I personally favored more airfields deployed reasonably far north, and we had quite a number of them. We had it for the Dew Line and so forth, and to deploy these squadrons of good fighters with air-to-air atomic weapons, and if that particular threat did not materialize, the bomber threat, the bear, the bison, and all the various ones, and you felt it then later, you felt for one reason or another the production had fallen off, it was negligible, you still then had a fighter aircraft, if it were necessary, to deploy your air forces in the NATO role in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But the deployment of Bomarks, you can't redeploy it, it's not easily. It's a very expensive, heavy ground installation.
Mm-hmm.
But you can move your... Even our Sabres were delivered to Europe by our pilots flying them over. And we had then got longer range aircraft. These could have been deployed over in Europe much more quickly. So they had two roles, and I think in the expensive, but I favored that that over the Bomarka.
With the Bomark, can it, now I should know this, but quite frankly I haven't had time to read through it, but can the Bomark also be used against any type of ICBM? I don't think
no,
so. Can
no, God,
no, it's no, strictly no, an aircraft.
Aircraft at speed.
Yeah.
This is why you have to go to these rockets with very high thrust, because they really have to. Some of these rockets that are coming in, they're very high, some of them just about outside the atmosphere, coming down, and they're coming in, 15,000 miles an hour, something like this. Well, the Bomark, all you can do, you have to have a rocket with
tremendous
thrust and variability. You have to be able to gauge it and keep turning it, guiding it on.
Yeah.
Now, the Bomark, I think bow and arrow would be about as useful against one of these as the Bomark.
Yeah.
It's purely an anti-bomber.
Well, if he was not in favor of them, at least he wasn't on them either night. Now, it's a politician's privilege to change his mind. Why the devil did they keep them on and bring in the atomic warhead?
I suppose by that time they were so far committed that it made sense to go on. If you have two choices, and I don't say they made the wrong choice, I would have made another, but if they had, they made the choice of the Bomark. It had a capability.
Yeah.
And if you had paid so much, it seems to me logical that you wouldn't scrap that capability you had, because you probably couldn't afford to go into some other means of doing it. So I would feel, once committed to it, whether it would be 5 or 10, let's call it X percent effect, or why throw that away? Because the warheads, in any event, now this thing I don't recall, that we actually, it's something the deputy minister could tell you, I don't think we paid for our atomic warheads.
Well, of course, there was a while there when, there's tremendous argument over whether or not we should have atomic warheads at all.
Oh, yeah,
you remember that?
Oh, I remember that very well.
And that was a little of an argument, I think. And did we not also have these, the Bomark station or plant, what is the word for it? The
Bomark station, I
Yeah, the station, shall we say.
Station, some call it a site, Bomark site.
But we had them in Canada, and everything ready to go except for the damned atomic warhead.
At Lamaquez in North Bay.
Yeah.
Well, without the atomic warhead, of course.
It was
very, very much like having a very fine rifle or a gun without any ammunition to fire in it. It's quite useless.
Yeah.
But we had committed ourselves that far.
Yeah.
And as I recall the arrangement, remember the European one, and I think the Canadian one was the same, you build your storage area for your atomic warhead.
Mm-hmm.
It's moved in by the United States.
Yeah.
They have guards on it.
Yeah.
You provide the housing and schooling for the guards, and they have a key, and you can't turn the key alone. It must be a decision between the two heads of states or to whatever level they delegated. And I feel that, as I remembered, the warheads really didn't. It was the collateral arrangements that cost money, not the warhead. Presumably, if they were ever used in anger, we would have paid for them. I would be surprised if we'd ever paid for any, but that's something I think I had left by the time that would have happened if it did.
Yeah.
So I think that's the reason that when Hellyer was the minister, he didn't do away with these things. They cost a lot of money, and they provided a measure of defense.
This, again, this is the last in our Bomark series. Now, who the devil is speaking, I'm not sure. But this is card 12. When the decision was made late in 1959 to have atomic bombs for the Bomark sites, there's another flurry of letters from institutions and individuals suggesting that we should not have atomic weapons stored in Canada. Typical of the replies sent to these people were as follows. Quote, first of all, Perks wishes me to assure you that the government of Canada is determined to do everything possible to bring about an agreement on disarmament.
The positions adopted by Canada and the World Councils clearly illustrate our stand in this regard. The government is convinced, however, that until an effective agreement on disarmament is reached, and as long as there are nations which resort to the use of force to carry out their policies, the Western allies must continue to take measures to ensure that they are in a position to defend themselves in the event of an attack. Then he goes on to say how Bomark is a purely defensive ground to air weapon, and God knows it. I would agree with that, that it's certainly not offensive. He goes on to talk about the NATO and how the government hopes that this sort of thing will discourage any would-be aggressor from using force. Was there any particular feeling that you remember, even within the armed forces, with respect to the use of nuclear weapons? Or I suppose you people may have to looked at the whole ready thing from a strictly professional point of view, perhaps.
I think that is so.
Yeah. I know.
I don't think any of us enjoyed the thought that the atomic weapon had been developed and had been used. I'm sure all of us had hoped that we would have been able to finish the last war without it. And I guess it would have been our hope that no one would ever have it. But I think our view was it's part of the arsenal of great powers today, and if you're going to defend yourself, you need to have it.
Yeah.
And the moral issues and the political issues, public opinions, was a matter for the politicians to deal with. And it was a very difficult problem for them, too.
It was a hell of a problem for them. Well, let's see the Bomark for the present. It'll probably come up, and I suspect it does later on in our card file. I was rather surprised. I was talking to George Stanley a couple of years ago, and he knew that I was writing this biography of Perks. And according to him, now this how much you would know about this, I don't know, but according to him, RMC didn't consider Perks very helpful as a Minister of Defense. I was a little bit surprised at that. Perks, as you know, he had never been a cadet at RMC. He wasn't an RMC type.
No.
Or grad or anything like that.
No.
But he had instructed there. And I don't know just what the hell Stanley would have expected a minister to do. Do you remember during that particular period, the conservative period, any great need for additional buildings or wide expansion, that sort of thing, by RMC? Do you remember being anti-RMC or anything
of
that nature?
No. I certainly did not get that feeling at all that he was in any way anti-RMC.
Mm-hmm.
Within our budgets, we always had naturally competing demands, whether we would put so much money to RMC or Collège Militaire Royal d'Assassin, or whether we'd add some barrack buildings at Petawawa, and we tried to work it out in the best way we possibly could. And it may well have been, and quite a natural feeling at RMC, if they wanted certain buildings, and there was a fairly good building budget, but they didn't get it, why they didn't add some more.
Mm.
I think that's, you found the feeling in certain commands.
Mm.
We spent a very great deal of money in doing Gagetown, and we made a fairly complete station. Now, others had to wait. Other commands said, well, we're getting nothing, everything's going to Eastern Command, and we need some.
Yeah.
Well, when we were doing Gagetown, we thought, here, let us do the job, we can get the money, finish it, and then we'll go and treat urgent matters in other commands, and then we'll come on a priority basis and fit us and so out. See, there's no point in a place like Gagetown, a new area, of putting up temporary buildings and tearing them down. We built the permanent buildings, a permanent type building, write it initially, which made compelling sense. Now, we could have put all sorts of missing huts and things in and gradually done it, but that would have been more expensive.
Yeah, in the long run.
So I don't know. I don't believe there was any, I had any feeling that General Perks was in any way antagonistic to RMC or any of the military colleges.
One of the things that Perks did, which was rather unpopular, and I can remember this quite well. Now, he has his own reason for it, but I wonder if you, how much you remember about it. Remember the period, oh, I think he'd been in maybe 1 year, maybe two, maybe only 1 year, when he brought out this, the stress of the role of the militia in civil defense matters. Mm-hmm. Now, was this his own brilliant idea, or was this imposed on him, or what, again, what is your memory of this?
I would say it was not wholly his idea. But I think that he regarded that sort of defense arrangement as a sensible one. I think he was worried that if a very difficult situation arose, a crisis arose, and possibly followed by a conflict, that it would be very difficult to explain to the public why there were no defensive arrangements for them personally, for their wives, their families, their home areas, their dormitories, if you want to call it. It's one thing, we've been used to fighting wars, some people going to the Boer War, the First War, the Second Korea, but no shells fell here.
Yeah.
We weren't bombed like London.
Yeah.
So, I can recall at times in England during the war, during the Battle of Britain, some people were definitely worried. Others, most were first class. But it was very depressing. I was stationed in London for at CMHQ for about 6 or 7 months, I've forgotten how long. And when I go home late at night to my flat, the tubes were just stations just absolutely filled with these people lying, someone caught, some, you've seen things. Others just said, fine, I'll go to bed. They hit me, that's that. Well, the more people who did this in the rushing, you know, it wasn't undue rushing, but hurrying to these subways and whatnot, it tends to spread a lowering of morale.
Yeah.
Now, if you believe you have some defensive arrangement, even no defense arrangement is perfect, I believe people will stand up to more.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't. We had no, when they call it survival equipment, I don't like that sort of word. It's, it sounds rather desperate, like there always be in England. But what was involved primarily was to teach not only the militia but the regular force how to rescue and look after people if our country was hit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, this had, this was sensible. If a war broke out quickly, we might be so damaged that we couldn't get a division, a brigade, outside the country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if this arose, we had at that time about 120,000 Navy, Army, Air, call it 40,000 Army.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why shouldn't these people, who are professionals, be highly trained in either role?
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are concentrated in camps like Petawawa, Gagetown, so they're reasonably mobile.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're well-trained soldiers, it was my view that they could be trained also in this other role. They're using their same communications equipment, but they're doing mostly a job that a sapper would do. They had to be able to know how to use blowtorches and how to prop up buildings and how to dig people out. Chaps who were drivers, were good truck drivers, were trained to run bulldozers.
Yeah.
Well, to me, this was quite sensible. Now, there was a problem. The problem arose over the militia. Whether there should be one plan that I inherited was one which broke down the militia. In fact, broke down the whole regimental structure, practically, and made them into survival teams.
Yep.
I felt this was wrong. Am I straying from subject?
No, because this is right on, as far as I'm concerned.
I felt this was wrong, that the traditional unit organization was quite good enough,
mm-hmm.
because you know perfectly well in warfare, a battalion commander made up a little battle group. I mean, he might use one platoon, he might take some machine guns, he might add an anti-tank weapon and so forth. He didn't deploy them exactly like the paper war establishment. He deployed them. He had so many resources, and he combined them in quantities and numbers to, with certain weapons to do a job. Well, I felt regimental structure at that time, a battalion, if you had it, was around 1,000. And you could train these people on the one hand to do, to the extent you had training time, to be soldiers for field warfare, and also to carry out useful role in civil defense if conditions arose where it was needed and you couldn't ship them off to a battlefield in any event. So I was a strong advocate of this. It happened in my time. And my biggest problem was to undo the recommendations that I inherited and to keep the regimental system and to call them. For example, the Queen's Own.
Yeah.
Any number of people would join the Queen's Own and train this way, but he wouldn't join the 121st Survival Column.
Yep, right.
He just wouldn't do it.
I agree.
Now, he may be wrong,
yeah.
but there is a glamour, there's a tradition.
Yeah.
And if they're on the job, even if it's this sort of a job,
mm-hmm.
and the platoon or company commander says, well, the Queen's Own will get them out.
Yeah. Yeah. Queen's Own will, rather than the 314th Survival Column.
I think this was the view, and I finally.
Do you think
we got it mostly along this line, and we got a lot of equipment for the militia.
Yeah.
Which, for example, one thing we needed for the militia, we needed to completely re-equip them with communications.
Yeah.
And the original plan was only to buy for the regular force. Well, under this arrangement, after some very hot discussions with Mr. Perks, we got enough to do the whole job, which then enabled them to a commander of a battalion or a brigade or whatever you want to call it, to handle his troops in a widely dispersed area, and you never could have with the old equipment they had.
Oh, Lord, no. No, I can... that I can well appreciate. Do you think, on reflection, that this survival training may have been thrust down the throats of the militia too quickly and too hard in its initial stages, because there was definitely a reaction to it?
There was, but I went to every command, spoke to all the militia people, and I knew them, of course, particularly well in Central Command. They had just come from it, and it had most of the militia in Canada. They would have preferred to have spent all their training time training for a field role.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think I tried to explain to them that the choice, they didn't have this choice. if they insisted on this, well, they wouldn't get anywhere at all. My point was, get onto this and get onto it loyally, and you'll be able to do both. But if you back it, then what can the government do? It can say, well, we may as well not have the militia. If they won't go at this alternative job, then what is the use of having them?
Now, this is the point that I remember Pertz making. I don't have, right with me, but he was speaking about along this line. He was saying that you are now coming into a different phase of warfare because of technological changes. And that for the first time, as you mentioned, Canada might have been on the receiving end of some of the ICBMs. Mm-hmm. Well then, if that was a fair possibility, if you're going to spend millions on the assumption that it is a fair possibility, what in hell would the role of the militia have been if it hadn't taken on survival? And too many people were already asking, of what use is a militia, and to him, the survival bit was a means of preserving, of retaining the militia.
It is correct, and I think it was also, I know perfectly well, in my mind, it was in recommending this organization and spending more money, I made it two ways, having read the RAND studies on the steps which should be taken, or they thought should be taken, to save as many people as possible in the event of attack by atomic weapons, and also feeling that there's no better organization than the militia. Admittedly, some units go down, up and down, but to get good COs, to preserve the militia and to give them a job. Because I felt that having seen and worked with a number and loaned equipment to a number of volunteer groups in the Central Command area, as you recall, there were a lot of civil defense groups which were not embodied in the military at all. Good, fine people, well motivated, but their equipment, their organization, their structure, and their training was just, it was not good.
Now this emphasis on the role of militia in civil defense, shall we say, remained fairly strong during the Perks period. But if I remember correctly, as soon as he left, it began to be played down somewhat.
Yes.
Now, any particular?
No, not in Mr. Hartnett. Not in Mr. Hartnett's time. While I was there, anyway.
Uh-huh. Well, it certainly was later. It is now.
Yes. Oh, it is now.
Yeah.
This is true. Well, I
can understand it, really.
Well, first of all, from an equipment point of view, there is a great deal of equipment stockpiled. If it has any use for something else, I can't think it is. We had more bulldozers than we would normally have. Mm-hmm. And we had perhaps more low loaders that we could bring them from Petawawa, various places like this, into Toronto or Ottawa, Camp Borton. Because if you had them all in the target area, this isn't very useful. You've got to have the greater part of your organization, ideally, should be completely out of the target area, but as close as possible to it, both the manpower, the equipment, and everything else. And I'll give it one example. That's a funny little one. When you go over planning of this sort, people talk to know great evacuation plans of Toronto and so, which I certainly didn't feel were very sensible as part of what we hit. And I had proved to myself once driving from Toronto back to Ottawa in an army vehicle, and we stopped and were having lunch somewhere, and the power went out for 2 hours. We didn't have enough gasoline to get the next filling station. All our gasoline pumps are operated electrically, and you can't get the stuff out except tear the top of the tank out and bail it out.
Yeah.
And there aren't big holes in it, you know, that you can put a pail down.
Yeah.
So we stockpiled a tremendous number of pumps, specially made, designed to
get
it out.
Yeah.
Also, we had quite a number. We used them, of course, for communications, 5 and 10 kilowatt, 110 volt AC generators run by Jeep engines.
Mm-hmm.
So you could power something.
Yeah.
You could just cut the power wires, which were dead, and put it across your generator, and you could do this, because you just couldn't move people without gasoline. You might, you figure the millions of gallons you have deployed in these sumps all over the place, and the only way to get them out is, well, some said, well, you could take one of these concrete drills, you know, and drill through the tarmac and cut the top. But again, you need power to run it.
Yeah.
The compressor is driven by an electric bloody motor. I mean, this is the sort of thing. These are just examples. I'm sure we have more valuable, very nice ones, aluminum ladders, extension ladders, any number of things. We have two or three depots filled with medical stores, and these are turned over to provincial governments, to hospitals and so, and Navy, Army, and Air. We have a big one at Petawawa, very, very big one. And so we had stores and bandages and all the various things the doctors need. We had it originally in what we call 25 COD in Ottawa. And, of course, that was a bad place to have it. And one was put in Petawawa, because no use having your central reserve in what you regard as a target area.
Yeah.
Now I'm drifting off.
No,
sorry.
this. Come up to it.
There was only one point. There was one point that a number of us discussed, and this was, what is the value of the militiaman in Toronto, if Toronto is hit, because his first of all, he won't be able to rally around the colors, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, his first pull, if you can call it that, is his family. Where is my family? Can I go and help them? Rather than to, if he could get to the assembly point, and then be directed to say someone else's family, he's going to be worrying about his own. And how many of them would be injured and so? Well, because of difficulties, if you say because of these difficulties we won't do anything, then I think it's just defeatist.
Yeah.
Toronto might not be hit, nor Ottawa may, and these people would be available there, and so forth, and outlying in the smaller town. So I feel that to say that there would be these various magnets drawing them, one their duty in a unit to help people and the other one to help his own family, I don't think it makes sense to say, well, we'll do nothing because there's a diversion here of some sort.
Boy. I have a card here on defense policy criticism. And of course,
one thing can I interject?
Yeah.
You know, we did start and almost completed a very good communication system for the continuity of government.
Yes, that comes later.
Comes later.
Yeah. This is an editorial from the Toronto Globe and Mail in 1959. In which it says, in defense, the trouble is that Canada has no policy or program. Things are done in fragments, and when the fragments are put together, all they suggest is an increase in subordination to the United States. Now, this is one of a great number, of course, which was typical of the Diefenbaker period, and typical of any period that followed after, or sometimes even before, this constant reliance on the United States. He says, the process has been going on for years. What brought it out into plain view was the Diefenbaker government's decision last February to scrap the all-Canadian Avro Arrow interceptor in favor of the all-American Bomark missile. At the same time, the government indicated that it was considering the placement on Canadian soil of American nuclear warheads under American ownership and American control. Economy was presented as a reason for going over to Bomark. But if the economy is guide, I suppose it means, but if the economy is to guide our defense, why do we maintain an old-style army, navy, and manpower levels which were established almost 10 years ago? Goes on to say, as for nuclear weapons, it does nothing for our sovereignty to have them based here under control of an American sergeant with an open telephone line to Washington or Colorado Springs. If Canada is going to have nuclear arms on its soil, or if Canadian troops in Western Europe are to be supplied with them, Canada cannot surrender control over their use. Now, of course, this is almost typical of the warped idea they have of American nuclear warheads, yes, on Canadian soil.
I don't know who wrote it. It's a pitiful letter. You can see it's very much like an ad.
Editorial. It's an editorial in the Globe and Mail, would you believe?
Dear God.
Yeah.
It's like the ads, you know, buy at this particular company to keep drumming the name, and he's put American, 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 so, well.
Yeah. It's something, you know, you could turn on the modern university in many ways.
Yeah.
In many ways. Oh, here, you come into this one. This is the Elliott Lake Nuclear Research Center. In January 60, evidently, the decision was taken not to locate the Nuclear Research Center at Elliott Lake. Mm-hmm. And naturally, the authorities at Elliott Lake protested, requested some Army unit to be stationed there to keep the town going. Evidently, at first Perks, despite the fact that it would cost quite a bit more money to run a unit from Elliott Lake rather than from Camp Borden, decided that a company of Provo Corps might go on, but you point out the extra cost of attempting to run a unit from here, but Perk said go ahead and changed his mind and told the people at Elliott Lake that he wasn't able to help them. Do you remember that?
I remember it very well indeed. I remember the final decision in his office after a telephone call to Bob Winters. Well, there was a real problem at Elliott Lake, economic. And the thought was that we should move a unit of the Army, or a school of the Army, to Elliott Lake in order to bolster up the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this did not attract me at all. I felt that this was a poor place to send these people.
Where the devil is it then?
Go into Sudbury, turn left and head for Sault Ste. Marie, right along the top of Lake Huron.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
About a third or halfway along, you'll find the large Manitoulin Island. And very close to that, there's a right turn, a road going about 60 miles straight north to Elliott Lake. And so you're about, I don't know if it's a half, two-third, but call it halfway from Sault Ste. Marie and halfway from Sudbury, out in the bloody blue.
Yeah.
Now, people who want to go there and pioneer and make money, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But we had our camps. We would have to go in and modify these, spend money, and we then took the cost of rations and everything else, and we let mythical contracts. I sent some chaps up there to say, right, we had so many people, what would the fuel be, the food, and so forth, and I figured out it was going to be a lot more expensive. And I sent an engineer officer up to have a look at the various buildings and whatnot, because if you have a unit or a school, it was the Provo School from Borden.
Oh, yeah.
Well, then you have to set up your school. So, and I may have been arguing speciously because I didn't like it, but I was arguing quite fairly. Every time we had anything in a budget, we had to pare it and be economical and so. Well, then it seemed to me ridiculous to to try to prime the economy at the expense of the army budget and lower morale as a result. So we were going into